And actually, it's really exciting to be here. That when Kim first approached, first reached out about doing this thing, it seemed like a really great opportunity to take advantage of the synergy that this joint meeting holds for us. And it's really, really exciting to be part of this poop conference. So, for the entomologists in the room, there's going to be nothing here for you. So you might as well go out and tweet about or something during the next 20 minutes. But I'm just going to provide some background, and this is really more addressed to our colleagues in the Tri-Societies group. Anyway, so I'm going to do a brief overview of fly management and associated with animal manures. And really we're talking about two groups of flies. You have the flies, first of all, that are associated with pasture habitats. Those are the horn flies and face flies, and those confined associated with confined animal facilities, the ones that we usually think of when we think of fly control around farms, the stable flies and house flies. Let's see, where's that? Looking for the arrow. Oh, wait, how do I advance? I had it a minute ago.
Arrow down.
Oh, here we go, arrow down. All right. So on the pasture habitats, here we're dealing with ephemeral, patchily distributed dung pats that are out there. And this is where we find our horn flies, which are small blood-feeding flies. They're essentially permanent ectoparasites on the animals, feeding on blood, except when they jump off to lay their eggs or they do a little dispersal. Also, the face flies, which is like a slightly larger version by appearance of the house fly. These flies feed on, these are sponging mouthpart feeders. They feed on liquids. They feed on eye and nasal secretions. And they're involved in the transmission of a variety of eye diseases. And they cause production losses. Again, they resemble house flies, but they're just a little bit bigger. Both the house fly, horn fly and face fly feed on these very temporary habitats that are out there, and management of them is pretty much restricted to management of the adult fly stage. Now, when we move to confined systems, whether it's poultry, swine, feedlots, dairy farms, here we have confined animals characterized, systems that are characterized by high animal densities and the more or less constant availability of somewhat stable accumulations of fly breeding substrates. And here we're talking mainly about the stable fly and the house fly. Stable flies, Tamoxifen calcitrans, are blood-feeding species with a proboscis that extends beyond the front of the fly. They're obligatory blood feeders. They're painful biters and very serious economic pest. Housefly, in contrast, does not have the capability of feeding on blood directly. They have sponging mouth parts. They can only feed on liquid foods. And their pest status is a little bit fuzzier. It's harder to demonstrate economic losses to houseflies. They're more of a disease concern and a public nuisance and public health concern. Life cycle of the fly, egg to adult in 8 to 14 days, depending on temperature. They can lay eggs after 3 or 4 days, and they can live for a very variable amount of time, depending on conditions, and can lay up to 600 eggs per female during a lifetime. Now, the house flies feed, regurgitate, and defecate on a wide range of food substrates, and again, they have sponging mouth parts, so they can only feed on liquid food, which means that when they feed in your hamburger, first they have to spit to do some extra oral digestion, get it all liquidy, and then lap it up. And this this habit of defecating around the barn leaves fecal deposits, which we can use to our advantage in monitoring systems. One of the standard ways of monitoring housefly populations is to count the number of fecal spots that accumulate on white index cards. Now the larvae, as Dana pointed out, feed on microorganisms that are present in the larval habitat. And this habitat can be a wide variety of semi-liquid substrates such as feces, food waste, compost piles, grass clippings, even post-harvest waste from vegetable fields. Some frightening figures, a quarter cup of cow manure can produce 1,000 flies. So on a modern dairy herd with over 1,000 animals, the fly breeding potential is 120 million flies per day. With chickens, we have some more frightening figures. A typical modern poultry house, cage layer house, produces 16,000 kilograms of manure per day with a fly breeding potential of 64 million flies per day. Now, clearly, there are a lot of things, a lot of elements that are keeping flies from reaching that full potential. And we're going to talk about what's out there naturally and what we can do in the way of fly management. Clearly, the first line of defense in any fly management program is substrate management. Then there's biological control, whether natural or augmentative. Insect growth regulators may play a role. Management of adult flies through traps, insecticides, and baits. And an element that I won't be able to talk much about today because of the time limitations is it's very important to have some sort of record keeping, whether you're counting fly spots or using other methods for monitoring flies, to for the producer to keep records of their fly population so they can see what's working, what's not, whether populations are increasing or decreasing over time. When we talk about manure management, there are a lot of elements to this. There are engineering and barn design considerations that play a big role in how many dirty corners you're going to have, how much manure can accumulate. Manure removal schedules are critical. So the best way is to get the all the manure out every 24 hours. If you do that, you can get it far, far away where there are no where there's no additional fly breeding. You would theoretically have zero flies. So the goal would be to have either very frequent manure removal or very infrequent manure removal to allow the colonization and establishment of a robust population of natural enemies. Moisture control. So fly larvae have a range of moisture that they can tolerate. And the lower range, lower end is probably down around 30-40%, upper limit around 85. So manure should be kept either very wet, liquefied, in a liquid storage system, or dried as much as possible. There was an excellent talk yesterday by one of the students on the choice of bedding materials. Wheat straw and other straw materials are often used by farmers because it's cheap and abundant, but it's probably just about the worst for producing flies. You get this nice mixture of the straw with the urine and the manure, and it's great for house flies and stable fly production. And there are some other bedding choices that are better choices for that. Another big source of fly breeding on farms are spilled and decomposing feedstuffs that are around the farm. And so this is important from the standpoint of those producers that choose to use an oral insect growth regulator such as Clarifly, which is quite popular right now, where it's fed to the animals and theoretically will block fly development in the manure. That doesn't do anything for all the breeding that's going on in non-manure substrates on the dairy farms where there's a lot of breeding going on. Of course, the manure needs to be disposed of after it's been removed. Just piling it onto a field next door isn't really going to solve the problem because flies will be able to continue developing in those fields for some time afterwards. So theoretically, it should be applied very thinly and then disked under as much as possible. So just a slide about barn considerations. In the upper left is a modern facility with a scraper that's going to come through, get all that manure out of there. They're not going to have a lot of fly problems. Some of the older facilities where the design wasn't so great, a little trough where the manure can be scraped out. You have dirty corners, places that don't get reached. And again, keeping in mind the fly breeding potential of small quantities of manure, a few bad spots can amount to a lot of flies. On dairy farms, probably the biggest source of fly breeding are where the calves are housed. And again, straw bedding being very commonly used. And these are often where a lot of your fly breeding is happening. Spilled feed, sometimes design considerations. If you have gaps under the feed bunks where you can get wet feed accumulating under the bunks, that is a source of fly breeding, as are spilled and wet silage and other feedstuffs. As far as the adult flies are highly attracted to certain commonly used feeds, and so wet brewer's grains, for example, are highly attractive to the adult flies, and you get larval development in areas where that feed is allowed to spoil and decompose some. Steam flake corn, which is quite popular in the Midwest, is another great source of attraction and potential development for flies. Now, stable flies, I'm gonna defer to Christina, who's coming on next. Stable flies have a somewhat narrower range of tolerance for their larval habitats, but certainly hay rings and areas where you have hay mixing with urine, rain, manure, and what have you, these are great sources for stable fly development. In poultry, it's much simpler. You've got the birds upstairs, at least in cage layer houses, the birds upstairs, the manure downstairs. And here, if the manure is kept dry, you get this nice community of natural enemies that move in. But a lot of poultry houses have water leaks. And if those water leaks are not attended to, those leaks can spread until pretty soon your nice piles of manure collapse and you end up with an ideal situation for fly breeding. So my area primarily is that of biological control of flies, and we're blessed with an abundance of natural enemies that we can manipulate and use. There are predators, parasitoids, nematodes that aren't so much a naturally occurring natural enemy, but are available commercially, and there is one species that is a natural parasite of the housefly. And then pathogens, fungal and viral. So just a brief whirlwind tour of some of the natural enemies. We have predators that feed on the fly eggs. Here's one of them, Pisciliaris monospinosus. Macrochelidmites, which are carried phoretically by the fly from site to site. You can see in the upper right-hand corner some macrochelidmites attached to the tail end of a stable fly being transported. There are beetles that live in the manure that feed, or that are aggressive predators on fly eggs and small stage larvae. There's a fly called the black dump fly in the genus Hydrotia, or sometimes known as Ophira flies. These are facultative predators whose larvae are predators of housefly and stablefly larvae. So there's a push in some places to use Ophira flies to replace houseflies. And there are commercial suppliers of these flies that, especially in Europe, where the organic farms are much more prevalent than in the U.S., and they're looking for most anything that they can use to help with their fly problem. The Ophira flies are widely used. There's a bit of a public relations policy problem still in the U.S. A lot of farmers are reluctant to use one fly to control another. Now, as far as things that are ready to use and widely available, the pteromallid parasitoids are probably the most common. There's a guild of about a dozen species, each with slightly different characteristics, but the life history is similar for all of them. Female parasitoids will drill into, sting, and lay an egg inside the puparium of the fly. Those eggs hatch, the larvae develop and consume the fly pupa as though it were a piece of meat, and then emerge anywhere from 18 to 28 days later, depending on the species. And these are available commercially. The companies that grow them advertise quite widely in producer magazines and popular trade journals, and they come to them shipped in as a stung pupae, which can deploy it in a variety of ways, my personal favorite being the Chinese food boxes. So, and there are two common genera of these parasitoids, Spilangia and Muscatophorax. They differ in some important ways in their life history characteristics. Ideally, we'd like to see a mix of those two genera used, and as a practical matter, the insectaries that grow and sell these wasps all sell blends. None of them want to commit to producing a single species, because when you're growing them by the millions, it's very hard to keep them separate. And so, as a practical matter, you get a mix anyway when you buy them. And you have to hope that these are good species that are in the mix and not some of the trash species, which are common contaminants in mass rearing facilities. They can be effective when used in an integrated management program with pesticides that are compatible with their use and a manure management program. You can get a real boost in parasitism, and more importantly, a real boost in your fly control. So this slide shows some very old data where flies were kept at or below what's considered the action threshold for flies by this integrated program using parasitoids. For pathogens, we have a couple of options. So there's the fungus Entomophthora musci, Bovaria, viruses, and BT. The Entomophthora musci complex is a fungal pathogen that is transmitted from one fly to another. An infected fly, as it nears the end of its life, becomes sick, climbs to whatever's handy in the environment, a hanging string or whatever, and then dies in situ, and the specialized structure comes out of the fly's mouth parts and anchors it there, and then there's this rain of spores that comes down. Now, typically, these infections are most common in the fall of the year, and you typically get these spectacular epizootics in northern states anyway, in the fall, September especially. So is it possible to accelerate this natural epizootic by releasing sick flies or introducing the E. musci into the environment early in the season? Yes, you can, but there's a catch. So we did try doing this by releasing sick flies into the environment early in the season. We were able to get a big bump and accelerate the natural epizootic cycle, but the catch is that it requires a high fly population to sustain the epizootic. So it worked well with high resident fly populations, but when we tried it on farms with low, small, or moderate populations, we didn't get anything, because you need that fly-to-fly interaction to get good spread of the fungus throughout the population. Bovaria and Metarhizium are two fungi with broad-spectrum activity against a wide variety of insects and other arthropods. They're also available commercially. These kill the fly in typically 4 to 6 days, but they're very easy to formulate. They have a good storage stability. You can apply them in a variety of ways as baits or sprays. And it was a long time coming, but there is a commercial supply now of fly control products in the form of a product called Balance. It's available in a bait and a sprayable formulation. And we all want to love this product. We'd love to love the product, but there's still some efficacy questions about just how effective it is. But I think there's a lot of potential here for this and other products, perhaps with somewhat better formulations. And we're all looking for the magic bullet of a Bovaria that'll kill the fly in 24 hours. One of the problems is that 4 to 6 days it takes to kill the fly is just a little bit too long. Another pathogen that does not yet have commercial potential is the salivary gland virus of the fly. We've worked on this for some years. So why would we care about a virus that affects the salivary gland? Well, we care because once the fly becomes infected, the ovaries are shut down and male mating competence is inhibited. So you're essentially sterilizing the fly if you can get the virus into the fly population. Natural occurrence is fairly low, but an infected fly can deposit a million virus particles during a brief feeding event onto a feeding substrate where other flies come to feed. But here's the catch. There's a paradox of salivary gland virus, and that is that flies are maximally susceptible to oral infection with the virus only during a narrow window right after emergence. And in fact, that window is before the time when flies normally feed. Once the fly is more than, say, 12 hours old, the paratrophic matrix becomes fully formed and the virus has a hard time getting through. This probably explains the very low incidence of the virus in nature. We have done some work on trying to develop a sprayable formulation. This works remarkably well, that all we have to do is make a smoothie out of infected flies and immerse or spray flies with it, and it gets through, presumably through the spiracles or other openings. So if there's a potential for this virus as a sterilizing agent, it would be in the form of a topical or a sprayable formulation rather than as a bait. When we get to the adult flies, we're talking about traps, baits, and sprays. How are we doing, Kim?
We're
good. We're near the end. So we've all seen these electrocuting light traps. Some of them have sticky boards. Some of them have electrocuting light grids that explode the fly, which are not so hot in restaurants. These light traps can be a useful element in a fly management program in sensitive areas, restaurants, milk rooms, egg rooms, offices, where you don't want the public to see a lot of flies. For stable flies, there are a variety of sticky traps that are available, mainly based on the alcinite and other reflective surfaces that are attractive to the flies. And there's been some interest in developing insecticide-treated visual targets that draw the flies in. They land on these blue and black fabrics and are treated with a lethal dose of insecticides. You can do this with stable flies. It's harder to do with house flies because of the resistance problem. Stable flies are still much more susceptible than house flies to the sprays that are available. There's a wide variety of bait traps out there. These two can be helpful in certain situations. They have a high capacity. The trap on the lower left has about 40, 50,000 flies in it. You can trap a lot of flies if you use the right attractant. There are also baited strips, such as the quick strike strip shown here. These are nice. When placed properly and used properly, they're expensive and have to be changed often, but these are also helpful for managing flies, especially in sensitive areas. And then we have the baits. I include Golden Malvern on the slide just because it's still available everywhere you go. You go into any farm store, if they're going to have one bait, it's going to be Golden Malvern. This product hasn't been effective probably for 30 years, but it's still the one that's out there. The active ingredient in Golden Malvern, methomyl, has really not been effective against flies for a long time. The newer products shown on the left is QuickBait, which contains the neonicotinoid imidacloprid. Unfortunately, we have a lot of resistance to that. When it first came out, it worked like gangbusters, but we're seeing resistance. The newest product on the market in terms of the baits is the one on the lower right, the Xyrox, which has a new active ingredient that is effective at managing resistant flies that are otherwise resistant to the other active ingredients in the baits. It used to be that fly sprays were the mainstay of fly control. Our options today are very limited. There, thanks to widespread resistance, the housefly was the first insect in which insecticide resistance was demonstrated. It's a very clever animal that very rapidly develops detoxification, behavioral avoidance mechanisms. There's very little left that we can use. I think cyfluthrin is probably about it that's out there right now in terms of a sprayable. That and a spinosad product. And we need to manage the few products that we have left carefully to try to slow the rate of development of resistance, because we're not likely to see a lot of new premise treatments coming along in coming years. And that about wraps it up. And one left is a very dark cartoon from a German site. It says in German, "Death comes faster than you think," and it shows a fly that's fallen through the ice. So anyway, that concludes the presentation, and thank you.